Amendment 2 to the Consolidated Highly Migratory Species FMP. It's behind tab number 1, document number 1. I believe there's a PowerPoint presentation to guide us through this document. Jackie Wilson is here to present to us. So whenever you're ready.
If you can't hear me, please just tell me to talk louder. I'm Jackie Wilson. I also have Leanne Southward Hogan here with me, coming in from Silver Spring, Maryland, to give you a presentation on our draft Amendment 2 to the Consolidated Highly Migratory Species Fishery Management Plan. So the purpose of the presentation and coming here today is to give you an overview of what we've included in our draft environmental impact statement, or the DEIS, and the proposed rule. The presentation is going to give you an overview of the current status of several shark species. There were a number of shark stock assessments that occurred recently. I'm also going to outline our alternatives and alternative suites that we analyzed in the DEIS and give you the impacts of the current preferred alternative suite. At the very end, you'll see information on where you can submit comments. Our comment period is currently open until October 10th. So in 2005 and in 2006, there were a number of shark stock assessments that occurred. You'll see abbreviations on this slide that I'll just define quickly. LCS is large coastal shark. Typically, we manage these species according to the large coastal shark, or LCS, complex. There was a shark stock assessment that was done in 2005 and 2006 on the LCS complex. Within that assessment, they also assessed sandbar sharks separately, and they assessed black-tip sharks as two separate populations. This was the first time this was done. They assessed a Gulf of Mexico population and an Atlantic black-tip population. Now, in that large coastal shark complex assessment, the peer reviewers decided that it was inappropriate to assess the complex as a whole, due to variation in many of the life history parameters for all the different species that comprise that complex. And so we've actually changed the determination of the LCS complex from being overfished with overfishing occurring to being unknown. Now, in the separate sandbar shark assessment that took place, it was determined that sandbar sharks are overfished with approximately 70 years in order to rebuild this stock. And it was also determined that overfishing is occurring. Now, for the blacktip shark stock assessment, the Gulf of Mexico blacktip sharks were found to be healthy. That is, they were not overfished, and overfishing is not occurring. However, the Atlantic shark blacktip population was determined to be unknown. Now, in 2006, a separate dusky shark stock assessment took place. This is the first time dusky sharks were actually assessed separately. The assessment found that the dusky sharks are overfished with a rebuilding time approximately 100 to 400 years, and overfishing is also occurring. The Canadians also conducted a separate poor beagle shark stock assessment in 2005. The Southeast Fishery Science Center and the Northeast Fishery Science Center reviewed this. They deemed it the best available science and appropriate for domestic management uses. And so we are using their determination of poor beagle sharks are overfished with approximately 100 years to rebuild, but overfishing is not occurring. So based on these latest stock assessments, new management measures are needed basically to help rebuild sandbar and dusky sharks, which are currently overfished with overfishing occurring, and poor beagle sharks, which have been determined to be overfished. So what we've done is we've come up with a range of management measures in order to rebuild these stocks and to stop overfishing. And currently, we are planning on having our final measurement management measures effective in early of 2008. So now I'm going to quickly go through what we did in our DEIS. You're going to see that it's organized slightly differently than how we have analyzed our management measures in the past. We've done something called alternative suites. And what we did is we have five alternative suites, which I'll outline in just a moment. But in each alternative suite, we looked at different key topics, and those seven key topics are on the slide right now. typically what we've done is we would take, for each key topic, we would go and we'd analyze a range of alternatives. Instead, what we've done in this document is we've taken an alternative suite, which is made up of each of these different key topics, and each alternative suite is different from one another by the particular version of the key topic that you see here. And we did this because we figured it's an easier way for people to understand how an entire suite, alternative, if you will, what the impacts of that is in a cumulative sense. And so you can get an idea of what the overall impact of all the different key topics are within a given alternative suite. And we thought this would just make things more transparent and straightforward. It's also broken down on a permit basis, so it's clear to fishermen how the management measures will affect them given the certain permit type that they may have. So I'm going to go through this in a little more detail, and hopefully it will make sense. I have additional handouts if it's helpful to kind of bring this point home. So these are the five alternative suites we looked at in the DEIS. These range from the status quo, which are the current management measures that are in place, all the way down to alternative suite 5, which would be to close the Atlantic, Caribbean, Gulf of Mexico, commercial and recreational shark fisheries. So according to NEPA, or the National Environmental Protection Act, we have to analyze a range of management measures. This pretty much covers the whole picture here. As I'm going to be going through the presentation, I'm going to outline what comprises each one of these alternative suites. Alternative suite 1, like I've mentioned, is the status quo. Alternative suite 2 would be management measures that affect just directed shark permit holders and recreational anglers. Under alternative suite 2, incidental shark permit holders would not be allowed to retain any shark products. Alternative suite 3 would be for both directed and incidental shark permit holders as well as recreational anglers. Alternative suite 4, which is currently our preferred alternative suite, would deal with developing a small shark research fishery that the agency would choose fishermen to participate in. There would also be management measures for fishermen that operate outside of the shark research fishery. This is mainly thought of as a way to continue data collection for future stock assessments, but also to curb effort within the directed shark fishery so that we can rebuild those stocks. And then alternative suite 5, as I've already mentioned, would be to close commercial and recreational shark fisheries. Next. So as you'll see, kind of here on the vertical axis, I've got the different alternative suites 1 through 5. Basically, throughout the presentation, I'm going to be going through each one of those alternative suites according to the key topics that are listed across the top there. So I'll be talking about quotas and species complexes for all the alternative suites, and then retention limits all the way over to recreational measures. As I mentioned, I have a handout, if it would be helpful for folks, at the table that basically has all of those boxes filled in that you can take home and hopefully easily compare between the different management measures that we analyze. So we're going to go through each one of those now. So under quotas and species complexes, okay, we looked at, now under the status quo, which is alternative suite 1, we would be maintaining what we currently have in place. We manage sharks by large coastal, small coastal, pelagic sharks, and then prohibited species. So we keep those same species complexes, and we'd also maintain the current quotas. So I'm not going to go through all the numbers here, but, you know, for instance, for large coastal sharks, we currently have a 1017 metric ton dressed weight annual quota. Small coastals are 454, and we would maintain the quotas that you have outlined there. The other thing I want to highlight is just we currently have in place a 60 metric ton whole weight kind of research set aside for our exempted fishing program. We give out exempted fishing permits to people who collect sharks for public aquarium, for researchers who work on sharks. And so this quota is a set aside that's specifically for that program, and that would be maintained under the status quo. Now, under Alternative Suite 2, just so folks know, you'll be seeing the acronym SKD. That stands for the Commercial Directed Shark Permit Holders. SKI stands for the Incidental Commercial Shark Permit Holders. And one of the things you'll notice throughout the presentation, in the DEIS, we're mainly focusing on large coastal sharks. We're not doing much in terms of management measures for small coastal sharks or pelagic sharks, except for porbeagle sharks that you'll see. So you just want to keep that in mind. So under Alternative Suite 2, there's a couple things that we would be changing. First of all, we would be removing sandbar sharks from the large coastal shark complex, and we would be establishing a separate sandbar shark quota. We're doing this because one of the recommendations from the sandbar shark stock assessment was they gave us a total allowable total allowable catch of sandbar sharks of 220 metric tons whole weight or 158 metric tons dressed weight. And that TAC would basically allow a 70% probability of rebuilding within 70 years. So we took that TAC, we basically calculated what a commercial quota could be, and we came up with 116.6 metric tons dressed weight for an annual sandbar shark quota. We then established or would establish what we're calling a non-sandbar LCS complex. It's basically the large coastal shark complex with sandbar sharks removed. And we established a commercial quota of 541.2 metric tons. Now, that quota comes off of, again, recommendations from the stock assessments that occurred. For the Gulf of Mexico and Atlantic blacktip stock assessment, they recommended that the catches of blacktip sharks do not change from historical levels. So essentially what we did there is we calculated what we had for our historical catch of blacktip sharks as well as other sharks besides sandbars, and we established a commercial quota of 541.2. Now, as I've mentioned, most of our management actions are going to be focusing on large coastals, and so we would maintain the status quo for small coastals and pelagics and blue sharks in terms of quotas. The one difference here is that based on the overfish status of porbeagle sharks, we would be placing porbeagle sharks on the prohibited species list. This would help rebuilding of these species within that 100-year time frame. We would also maintain the 60 metric ton whole weight EFP research set aside, except for we would change how that quota is allocated to specific species. For instance, we'd set aside 2 metric tons dress weight specifically for sandbar sharks, and we'd have 1 metric ton available for collection of sandbar sharks for public display. The other metric ton would be available for research under exempted fishing permits. The rest of that 60 metric tons set aside would be available to all other shark species except for dusky sharks, which we would no longer allow to be collected for public display. Now, we'd also be changing in how we account for over-harvest and under-harvest slightly under Alternative Suite 2. We would be removing over-harvest from the next season, as we currently do under our management regime for sharks. However, we'd be limiting the amount of under-harvest that can be carried over to only 50% of the base quota for species that have been determined to be healthy. We would not allow carryover of under-harvest for species that have been designated as overfished, overfishing occurring, or that have a status of unknown. And this is just to help rebuild those stocks more quickly or within the designated time frame. So for Alternative Suite 3, again, this would be applying to both directed and incidental shark permit holders as well as recreational anglers. We would have the same regime that I just explained under Alternative Suite 2 for the quotas and species complexes. So we'd set up the same quotas and the same species complexes as I just explained. Under Alternative Suite 4, the preferred alternative at this time, the shark research fishery, we would also set up the same quotas and species complexes as I just went through. Under Alternative Suite 5, we wouldn't have any commercial quotas for sharks, essentially since we would close the commercial and recreational shark fisheries, retention of any shark would be prohibited. Next. Okay, next I'm going to go through the topic of commercial retention limits. And if you have further questions on this, I also have another handout that explicitly goes through how we set up the retention limits and how we calculated quotas. So I'd be happy to share that with you after the presentation. Currently under Alternative Suite 1, which would be the status quo, we have a 4,000-pound dress weight of a large coastal shark trip limit for directed shark permit holders. There is no trip limit for small coastals or pelagics. Incidental shark permit holders are limited to 5 large coastals and 16 pelagics and small coastal sharks combined per trip. So if we went with status quo, that would stay in place. Alternative Suite 2, again, this would only apply to directed shark permit holders. Incidental shark permit holders would not be allowed to retain shark products under Alternative Suite 2. We would establish a commercial retention limit of 8 sandbar sharks and 21 non-sandbar sharks per trip. Okay, there would be, if you had a directed shark permit under Alternative Suite 2, there would be no trip limit for small coastals and pelagic sharks. One of the other things under Alternative Suite 2 is we would be proposing that all sharks be landed with their fins on. Currently, sharks just have to be landed with their second dorsal and anal fin attached. Under Alternative Suite 2, we'd be proposing that sharks be landed with all their fins on. Their heads could be removed, the sharks could be cleaned at sea, but all of their fins would have to remain on through landing. Under Alternative Suite 2, we'd also, we're proposing to have no sandbar sharks be retained with pelagic longline gear on board. Okay. Under Alternative Suite 3, this applies to directed and incidental shark permit holders. And what you'll see is because we've increased the universe of permit holders, this results in a decrease in the overall retention limit. So under Alternative Suite 3, directed and incidental permit holders would be allowed 4 sandbar sharks and 10 non-sandbar LCS per trip. We'd have, if you had a directed shark permit, you would have no trip limit for small coastals and pelagics. Incidentals would be limited to the status quo of 16 pelagics and small coastals combined. And again, under Alternative Suite 3, we're also proposing that all sharks be landed with their fins on. Now, under Alternative Suite 4, the shark research fishery, again, this is the preferred alternative suite at this time. Within the shark research fishery, what we would have are higher trip limits for sandbar sharks and non-sandbar sharks that fishermen would be able to land than fishermen operating outside of the research fishery. And right now, what we're envisioning for the shark research fishery is that the shark scientists within the agency would basically identify the research objectives for a given year, basically the research that needs to be done on sharks that comes out of the stock assessments. The agency would then put out an annual notice. They would list what those objectives are, what the criteria are for fishermen to be selected upon. Fishermen who are interested in working in the shark research fishery would be able to apply. The agency would then select those fishermen. Right now we're envisioning between 5 to 10 vessels. And the reason we're choosing 5 to 10 vessels is basically sandbar sharks would only be allowed to be landed within the shark research fishery. Boats operating outside of the shark research fishery would not be able to retain sandbar sharks. So we calculated that approximately 5 to 10 vessels would get the entire 116.6 metric tons of sandbars. And that would be enough that those boats operating within that research fishery could basically still get money on shark products as they currently do today. So we basically would be shrinking the universe that could land sandbar sharks to what it currently is now. We'd also have observers on those boats, so we would be continuing to collect data for future stock assessments. At the same time, we'd be allowing a few shark fishermen to still make money off of shark products. Now, fishermen that would be operating outside of the research fishery, that is, fishermen who were not interested in participating in the research fishery or that were not selected, would be not allowed to land sandbar sharks, but they still would be able to land other sharks besides sandbars. They would be given a 22 non-sandbar LCS trip limit. They'd also be able to land small coastals and pelagics based on their permit type. Directed guys would have no trip limit for small coastals and pelagics, and the incidental permit holders would be limited to 16 pelagics and small coastals combined. We'd also are proposing to have all sharks landed with their fins on for boats both in the research fishery and operating outside of the research fishery. Now, under Alternative Suite 5, to close the commercial and recreational shark fisheries, there would basically be no retention of any sharks. Okay, next. Under time area closures, under the status quo, we would maintain the current highly migratory species time area closures that we have in place, and this applies for pelagic longline, bottom longline, as well as gillnet. Under Alternative Suite 2, the directed shark permit holders alternative, basically we would maintain our current HMS time area closures, but we'd also be implementing 8 marine protected areas that have been are going to be implemented by the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council. The South Atlantic Council has come to us and has asked us to backstop their measures. We've done this for other councils. For instance, the Gulf Council recently had us backstop their management measures with the Madison Swanson and Steamboat Lump closures in the Gulf. And since many of the shark fishermen use the same type of gear that fishermen who are fishing under South Atlantic Council regs, this basically would close any potential enforcement loopholes. So in the next slide, I'm going to be showing you where those eight MPAs are located. Under Alternative Suites 3 and 4, we do the same thing as I just explained in Alternative Suite 2. We'd maintain the current Tamari closures, and we would also implement the eight MPAs that I just explained. Alternative Suite 5 would essentially end up with all of the Atlantic, Caribbean, and Gulf of Mexico areas being closed to shark fishing. Next slide. This is a map, which you may or may not be able to see. Of the eight marine protected areas, they basically span from North Carolina all the way down to the Florida Keys. They're very small, but these would be closed to all bottom longline fishing, essentially, in these areas. Again, this has been based off of what the South Atlantic Council is implementing right now. Next. Okay, reporting. Basically, we are going to be looking at some changes in our reporting that we use for quota monitoring. Under the status quo, we would maintain our current observer and logbook requirements as well as our dealer reporting, which is currently dealers have to have their reports postmarked within 10 days of the end of the bi-monthly reporting periods. Under Alternative Suite 2, we would basically, because we have only directed permit holders landing sharks and we have slightly higher retention limits than under Alternative Suite 3, we would require dealers to report within 24 hours of receiving shark products so that we could prevent over-harvest of the shark quotas. We would still maintain our logbook and observer requirements. And one of the things that we would also are proposing to change is currently when we have unclassified sharks coming in from our dealer reports, we count those against a large coastal shark quota. But any unclassified sharks under Alternative Suite 2 would be counted against the sandbar shark quota. And this is to help prevent loopholes where people either are not going to be reporting sandbar sharks as sandbar sharks, or if the sandbar shark quota closes, that it could create other potential problems. So we're proposing that under Alternative Suite 2. Alternative Suite 3, again, because we have a larger universe of permit holders that would be allowed to take the quota, we've set the retention limit such that we hope that the seasons the quota would be able to maintain throughout the year. And we are changing the reporting requirements for dealers only slightly. Currently, as I said right now, dealer reports have to be received by NIMS postmarked and sent to NIMS within 10 days of the end of reporting period. But under Alternative Suite 3, they would just have to be received by NIMS within 10 days. So fishermen would just be responsible to make sure they got those reports, or the dealers would have to be responsible to make sure they got those reports in the mail on time so that NIMS could have them received within 10 days of the end of a reporting period. Again, we'd maintain our current logbook and observer requirements, and any unclassified sharks would be counted against the sandbar shark quota. Now, under Alternative Suite 4, the quota monitoring would change slightly for within versus outside the shark research fishery. We would have 100% observer coverage on the boats that operate within the shark research fishery, and we would monitor the quota based on those scientific observer reports. For boats that were operating outside of the research fishery and were landing sharks, we'd still rely on dealer reports that had to be received by NIMS within 10 days of the end of a reporting period in order to monitor shark landings. Under Alternative Suite 5, where we would close the commercial and recreational shark fisheries, we would work with our Southeast office to improve the logbook discards that we get in our coastal fisheries, which is also known as our snapper grouper logbook. Currently, right now, only 20% of the fishermen are required to report discards. So we would try to improve that so we could get a better estimate of what shark discards are occurring. In addition, we'd ask observers be placed on other longline and gillnet fisheries to monitor shark bycatch that's occurring in other fisheries. Next. Okay, seasons. Currently, right now, the shark fishery is managed on trimesters. Under Alternative Suite 2, we would basically have one season. It would open up on January 1 of that year, and it would stay open until 80% of either the sandbar or non-sandbar LCS quota was met. We would then close the season with a 5-day notice of filing in the Federal Register. We've chosen 80% as a way to prevent overharvest. That is, we assume fishing is going to still occur during those 5 days when we're closing the fishery. It's one of the things we've actually asked for comments back on people, if 80% is an appropriate threshold to prevent overharvest, or perhaps it's maybe we could go with 90%. But it's one of the things we're specifically asking for comments on people regarding. The pelagic and small coastal fisheries would each close when their respective quotas reach 80%, and again, it would close with a 5-day notice within filing in the Federal Register. Alternative Suites 3 and 4 would have the same thing that I just explained for Alternative Suite 2. There'd be one season. It would close when the respective quotas reached 80%. And under Alternative Suite 5, we basically would have no commercial seasons because there would be no commercial shark fishery. Regions. Under the status quo, we have three regions. We have the North Atlantic, South Atlantic, and Gulf of Mexico. Under Alternative Suites 2, 3, and 4, we're proposing having one region. One of the reasons we have are proposing this is because we found, especially in areas where you have bordering regions, there's been some confusion about shark dealers when they can actually purchase shark products. And if a region is closed, they're not supposed to purchase any shark products. So this would simplify all of that because there would only be one region. We've also had issues, especially in Florida, from the east coast to the west coast of Florida, people catching sharks in the Gulf of Mexico, putting it on a truck, taking it over to the South Atlantic, and then it gets counted against the South Atlantic quota. So this would simplify our quota monitoring because everything would come from one region and one quota. Now, under Alternative Suite 5, again, we'd have no commercial regions because we would not have a commercial shark fishery. Next. Okay, so recreational measures. I've basically been focusing on commercial measures. Recreational measures, under the status quo, we'd maintain what we currently have in place. That is, recreational fishermen are allowed to have one large coastal shark greater than 54 inches fork length, except for prohibited species. In addition, they're allowed one Atlantic sharp nose and one bonnet head per person per trip. Under Alternative Suite 2, we would maintain the size and bag limit that we currently have in place. However, due to some identification issues, especially with misidentification of prohibited and overfished shark species, we are proposing to limit recreational anglers to only being able to land species that are easily and positively able to identify. And that list right now is up on the screen. It's bonnetheads, Atlantic sharp nose, nurse, tiger, lemon, all the hammerheads, and shortfin mako, common thresher, oceanic white tip, and blue sharks. Okay, this is another thing we're asking for specific feedback on, whether or not people think this list is appropriate, if there are species that should be removed, or if there are species that should be added. Okay, we'd have, for Alternative Suites 3 and 4, we'd have the same management measures that I just explained for Alternative Suite 2. And under Alternative Suite 5, we basically would only have a catch-and-release fishery for recreational fishermen. Okay, I know I've thrown a lot of information at you. So I want to quickly just go through a summary of what we are currently proposing under the preferred Alternative Suite 4. And as I've mentioned, we'd have a separate sandbar shark quota of 116.6 metric tons per year, and we'd have a non-sandbar large coastal shark quota of 541.2 metric tons. We would have a small research fishery. Fishermen operating in that research fishery would be allowed to land sandbar sharks as well as other sharks, except prohibited species. Fishermen operating outside of the research fishery would not be able to land sandbar sharks, but they would be able to retain other sharks, specifically 22 non-sandbar large coastal sharks per trip. That would be for both incidental and directed permit holders. And then small coastals and pelagics would be the same depending on their permit type. We would implement the eight marine protected areas that are currently being implemented by the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council. And all the sharks landed would have to be landed with their fins still attached. Again, fishermen would be able to take their heads off and clean the sharks at sea. They would just have to come to port and land the sharks with their fins on. We would go to one region with one season. Our dealer reports would have to be received by NIMS within 10 days of the end of a reporting period for those boats that are operating outside of the research fishery. That's how we would monitor the quota. For boats inside the research fishery, we'd monitor the quota from the scientific observer reports. We would close the sandbar and non-sandbar large coastal shark fisheries when either quota reached 80% with a five-day notice. And again, all unclassified sharks would be counted against the sandbar shark quota. We would maintain the status quo for our recreational size and bag limits. However, we would limit recreational anglers to only landing the easily and positively identifiable species that we have listed up there. Okay? So I want to go over what we analyzed in terms of impacts for the preferred alternative suite. And as many of you know, we look at ecological and economic. And in the next slide, I'll give you some information on the number of permit holders that would be potentially affected by these management measures. Overall, we anticipate having positive ecological impacts. We'd be reducing the quotas and trip limits based on recommendations of the stock assessments. Again, those would be needed to be implemented in order to rebuild many of these shark stocks. We'd be reducing our landings. Currently, we've estimated about 728 metric tons of sandbar sharks are landed each year in the commercial shark fishery. We would be reducing that down to 116.6 metric tons. So as you'll see, while this would be a positive ecological impact, it obviously has a negative economic impact associated with it. And we'd be keeping the non-sandbar large coastals just about the same, from about 582 down to about 541.2 metric tons per year. Based on how we've actually set up the shark research fishery and our trip limits, we do anticipate increases of sandbar sharks from about 9.6 metric tons per year that currently occur in the directed shark fishery to about 13.1 metric tons. But when we calculated the overall catch and discards of sandbar sharks under the management regime, it would still be below that recommended TAC of 158 metric tons dress weight. We would be reducing discards of the non-sandbar large coastal sharks from about 153 that occur currently to about 56 metric tons per year. And we also anticipate a decrease in dusky sharks from about 33 down to about 9 metric tons per year. We'd also would be reducing landings of porbeagle sharks by placing them on the prohibited species list. However, there's not much of a directed porbeagle shark fishery in the United States currently. There's only about 1.6 metric tons landed per year. Most of the porbeagle sharks that are caught are discarded by fishermen. They don't want to catch them. And we've looked at what the disposition is of those discards, and most of them are discarded alive, so we don't anticipate having a large number of dead discards of porbeagle sharks. Now, in terms of economic impacts, we do expect negative economic impacts associated with these management measures. Fishery-wide, we're estimating losses in gross revenues from mainly reducing the sandbar quota, but also in a reduction of the non-sandbar LCS trip limit of about $1.8 million per year fishery-wide. We're anticipating most of those negative impacts would be for fishermen operating outside of the research fishery that would not be allowed to retain sandbar sharks, since sandbar sharks are the primary species that are targeted in the shark fishery. We have estimated that the total gross revenues for the 5 to 10 vessels operating within the research fishery would be about $490,000 per year, and then depending on the number of vessels that were in that, that's looking at about $98,000 to $49,000 per vessel per year. The total gross revenues for all the vessels operating outside of the research fishery is estimated to be about $1.5 million per year. And one of the other things we looked at in our cumulative impact statement, our cumulative impact section, is we looked at the permits that shark fishermen currently hold, and many shark fishermen hold multiple permits. They actually don't survive just on shark products anymore. And so we tried to look at where effort from the shark fishery could potentially be redistributed in other fisheries. And what we found that if shark fishermen don't currently have permits in other fisheries, they'll be hard-pressed, basically, to enter those fisheries because many of them are limited access or have an IFQ system in place. So we anticipate that their negative impacts won't necessarily be able to be made up in other fisheries. Next. So quickly, I just want to go through the couple more things. One of the things is the number of permit holders that we anticipate will be affected by these measures. Currently, we have 231 directed, 298 incidental, and 269 shark dealer permits that are out. However, Most of those is kind of latent effort within the fishery. We have, on average, 129 vessels with directed shark permits and 62 vessels with incidental permits that are actually reporting landings of sandbar sharks. So this is what we would consider our active universe or active vessels. So we're anticipating about 129 directed permit holders and 62 incidental permit holders would be most affected by these management measures. And then just so folks know, most of our directed and incidental shark permit holders are in the states of Florida, New Jersey, and North Carolina, and most of our shark dealers are located in Florida and North and South Carolina. Okay, some other things I want to touch on really quickly here. We also address a couple other things in the rule. For one, we analyzed alternatives for the timing of the shark stock assessments. We also analyzed some alternatives for the timing of the release of our HMS Stock Assessment and Fishery Evaluation Report, or also known as our SAFE report. We are going to update our dehooking requirements for small-tooth sawfish in the bottom longline fishery based on a modification that was currently done to the 2003 biological opinion. We are also clarifying that dealer reports need to be species-specific. As I've mentioned before, we are still getting unclassified sharks in our dealer reports. According to our regulations, dealers are supposed to be reporting on a species-specific basis, and so we're just making that clear within our regulations. We're also clarifying the definition of who needs to be a dealer or who needs to have a dealer permit, and basically it is the first person who receives a shark product has to have a dealer permit. So we're clarifying the language and our regulations for that. Next. Very quickly, we looked at four alternatives that deals with the timing of stock assessments and the timing of the HMS SAFE report. Currently, according to the 1999 FMP, shark stock assessments have to be done every 2 to 3 years. However, what we're finding is that by the time we have a shark stock assessment done, we then develop management measures. We then put those management measures in place. We may have them in place for about a year before the next stock assessment has to be done. And due to how many shark species operate, we may not actually be capturing any effect of those management measures in that next stock assessment. So what we're proposing and what our preferred alternative now is to have it at least every 5 years. This is currently what our S&T office does their stock assessments. And what we believe this will do is allow some more time for those management measures to be in place before the next stock assessment takes place. Under alternative 8 there, currently under the 99 FMP, we have to have a SAFE report out every January and February of each year. However, we're now proposing just to have it out every fall of every year to basically just give the agency more administrative and discretionary time to get the SAFE report out. So it would still be done every year, just would be produced in the fall instead of January, February of every year. Now, updating dehooking requirements. In the 2003 biological opinion, the scientists had not done the research at that point to know whether or not dehooking devices would be detrimental to small-tooth sawfish. Small-tooth sawfish are an endangered species. And so under the 2003 biological opinion, it basically stated that any small-tooth sawfish that was hooked would basically have the line cut as close to the hook as possible. The dehookers were not supposed to be used on the animals. Since then, they have done research. They found that they can actually beneficial effects can be seen for small-tooth sawfish if you remove the hooks. So now what they're doing is fishermen are now allowed to use dehookers on small-tooth sawfish. They're asked to keep the animal in the water, keep water flowing over the gills, and if it is safe for fishermen to attempt to dehook the animal, however, they are large and intimidating, and if it is not safe for fishermen, then they can cut the line as close to the hook as possible. So. Now, this doesn't really apply anymore because we've actually finished all the public hearings on this list, but this is where we've had our different public hearings. We've also met with all of the fishery management councils. Tomorrow we meet with the South Atlantic Council, and we've met with the Atlantic States Commission. We're going to be having an advisory panel meeting the first week in October, and we'll also be giving a presentation and taking comments at those points. So. This is just our tentative timeline. We had scoping on these issues in January of 2007. We then put together a pre-draft for our March 2007 AP meeting. Based on comments that we received, we put together our draft environmental impact statement, which we're talking to you all about today. And we are looking at having a final environmental impact statement in the late fall of 2007 with the final rule effective in early 2008. We have the address there, an email address, phone number, fax number, where folks can submit comments, and our comment period is open until October 10th. So with that, I will stop talking and open up for questions.
Thanks, Jackie. We have about 10 minutes in total for questions and comments right now. Anyone on the council? John Nelson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Jackie, for the presentation. It's a lot. I've already gotten feedback from some of your public hearings, so some folks are questioning, I guess, the Poor Beagle action, which is to prohibit it. And I noted that you have it as overfish, but overfishing not occurring, and you're trying to rebuild in 100 years. If you have landings of 1.6 metric tons, and you allowed that level of fishery to continue, what would be your rebuilding time frame?
If I don't actually know off the top of my head what the rebuilding time frame would be. As I've mentioned, there isn't much of a directed fishery in the United States. Most of the directed fishing occurs in the Canadian fishery for poor beagle sharks, at least the Northwest Atlantic population that we're talking about. So if we continued at the 1.6, I can't really tell you what the rebuilding time frame would be. But it was just one of the measures that we have proposed to basically help rebuild that population. So.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like you'd add much to the time limit of reducing it by that amount, and it seems like I recognize there's not many people that do fish for them, but apparently there's some, and some apparently are my constituents, which I didn't know. And so they were just questioning why put it on the prohibited list if it's such a small number of folks that are directing on it, if you will, if it's not going to add to the rebuilding time frame, it's having that available as a Gulf of Maine fishery in a very limited fashion seems to be a reasonable request. And they just kind of looked at it as this was a small thing that they could that the service could just say, well, we'll just eliminate that, and it makes it cleaner for you. So that's a little feedback for you. If you don't have the answer for that now, that's fine. We can send some comments in. The other thing I was curious about, you were going to have, I guess, one zone and one season, and that ran from the northern end of, or down east Maine, down to the Gulf of Mexico. Right through the Gulf of Mexico, you're gonna have one season. Does that really fit for the migratory activities associated with those species, or some people gonna, or is it so large a season that it's not the way you should do it? I don't see how the one season would work.
Well, the way we've structured the retention limits, spread that out over the historic effort, and whether or not that historic effort will be realized is something that's remained to be seen. But the way we've pictured it is that the retention limits would allow that basically the fishery to stay open year-round. The retention limits have been reduced such that it would allow fishing to continue year-round so that when the species are available in different regions at different times, the fishery would still be open and folks would still have fishing opportunities. So that's the rationale, part of the rationale behind the retention limits as well.
I think you're going to run into some problems with that. If you've got quotas on various species, that's probably going to be reached at some location sooner than others and then shut down the whole fishery, and some folks are going to be totally disadvantaged. Thank you.
Frank Blount.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My questions are on the poor beagle, too. I guess I know it's not a directed fishery, but I know a few of them are caught recreationally. I've caught a few myself. But I understand that there's also some that are landed in tournaments. And so while it's not a directed fishery, I think it is important to those tournaments. So I would hope someplace under the economic impacts that that would come in play, that there's something said about that. And also, if there's 1.6 metric tons per year, it does sound like the majority of them are caught outside of U.S. waters. So regardless of whether we close the directed fishery or have it, I don't think it's going to make a bit of difference on the rebuilding time frame unless we get some international cooperation there. And it's considered probably a trophy fish because they are so rare. I mean, the last one we caught was over 300 pounds, and it was probably a record. So, I mean, I would hate to see somebody catch a lifetime fish and not be able to keep it. They're also very good eating, so it's not a fish that's wasted. And as far as easily identified, you know, you're saying you can keep the Makos. Poor Beagles, to a lot of people, would think they were Makos. Unless you look at the teeth or saw the things. I mean, anybody who knows them can tell them apart, but I think some of the recreational may not be able to tell them apart. So just something to keep in mind there. And for 1.6 tons, I don't think we're accomplishing a lot. Thank you.
Kimbrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of comments and then a question. Jackie, you didn't give the presentation, by the way, to Mid-Atlantic, did you? Wasn't it someone else,
no,
or was it?
Carol Brewster,
I wasn't at that. So I'm familiar with that. But just a little bit of history for everybody, and I'll start it out real plain. This shark plan is probably one of the service's biggest failures, a complete failure from day one, and I'll explain why. Having dealt with swordfish in the longline fishery from Yucatan Peninsula to the Grand Banks of Newfoundland and beyond in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, I dealt with a lot of sharks, more than most of you will ever see. And I dealt with shark experts at the time, Jack Casey out of Rhode Island and Jose Castro out of Florida. And what you need to understand, at that point we were trying to understand more about sharks and their migrations, doing tagging along with swordfish. I mean, that was the prime work that we were doing. But I made trips with those fellows aboard doing a lot of shark tagging. And there was no plans there. There was no management plans. The shark plan is less than is about 19 years old. 19 years ago, the service was going around asking the industry to get involved in the shark fishery, promoting this fishery, heavily promoting this fishery as an underutilized species that had a lot of opportunity for a lot of boats from the Gulf of Mexico to New England. The concern that I've got today when we look at the numbers that are generated up there, which I have no confidence in whatsoever, I have no confidence in anything that's done with sharks at all. When I hear a statement like, if they don't know what kind of shark it is when it's landed, it's automatically called a sandbar. I mean, that's not a real good way of identifying. That's not like a problem we got with skates. But that's not the issue. The issue is the agency did one of two things. Either totally screwed up its estimation of biomass and the biology of sharks initially, or totally underestimated the potential of effect of commercial fishing on these sharks. It can only be one of the two. But the way these presentations are coming down now, without some history in it, and I recognize that you probably weren't involved, you're probably still in school at this point. Your institutional knowledge just doesn't exist, but somewhere in HMS it should be there. It has to be noted that all of the blame is now shifted towards the commercial industry portion of this as overfishing. The promotion for this fishery to even begin to be developed came from the agency with low-interest loans. And there may be some people around the table that remember it. I certainly do. I just don't like to sit back and hear the industry blame for everything that's going wrong. It's not all their fault. Nowhere's near it. There's been some very significant underestimations of biomass or life history or whatever it is that's compounded this problem. And when I do attend public meetings, as the public hearings that are going on, I think the majority of the shark industry is going to be saying, shut it down. Shut every damn bit of it down forever for everybody. If we're looking at 70 to 400 years, 400 years, you know, I'll probably be dead in 400 years with a little bit of luck. You know, so will a lot of the other fellas. You know, but it's not as cut and dried as it appears. So in your estimation, ma'am, what do you feel like there's been adequate biological work done to make the projections for this fishery all along, or do you think they totally underestimated the potential of commercial fishermen?
Well, in terms of, I guess, the confidence I have in the stock assessment, which I think is where you're coming from and how they've done the stock assessments in terms of estimating the status of these stocks, yes, I have confidence in the science that's been done. And it was done according to the CDAR process, which is an open process. I don't, many of you probably know how that is, but there's three workshops. People come with data. Scientists review whether or not it's appropriate for the assessment. Then they have another workshop that's open to the public, and they do the assessment. And then they have a third workshop that the assessment is reviewed by independent peer reviewers, and they deem whether or not it's best available to science. They also give recommendations on other research that can be done, which is one of the objectives the shark research fishery would meet. But based on that, I think it's one of the best processes we've had in place for stock assessments, and I think they're getting the best information they can from the data they have available. I have no doubt that there's probably some issues with the data, but they make the most that they can out of the data they have available. I think when this fishery was promoted, it was promoted for a meat fishery. I think now it has switched over with the primary focus being on a fin fishery, sandbar sharks being the animals that are targeted because they have some of the largest fins and they have the largest value associated with them. So, what we found out about sharks, I think, in the scientific realm is that sharks are not, they do not have a life history that makes them particularly good for heavy exploitation and commercial fishing. Whether or not that was known at the beginning of, the shark fishery or when the shark fishery was promoted, I don't know. But I know now that, and at least in the 90s, it was begun to be known that sharks just don't have the life history that lends them to heavy exploitation and a commercial fishery type of thing. So that's pretty much all I can speak to that.
We're at the 2:30 agenda item, which is skate. We still have monkfish presentation and monkfish issues to discuss. If the council wants to continue to talk about sharks, I'll entertain more comments. You still want to talk about sharks, Dave? That would be helpful. We need to stay on agenda. Okay. Thank you.